Russian President Vladimir Putin repeats his call for security guarantees from the West as he blames the U.S.-led NATO for escalating tensions over Ukraine. Iran's President Raisi says a principled policy of his country is to support the stability and sovereignty of neighboring Iraq. Palestinians hold a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli soldiers in Ramallah on Wednesday. I'm Behrouz Najaf. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin stressing that the West should give security guarantees to his country as tensions go on over Ukraine.
Our reactions will depend not on the negotiation process, but on the unconditional security of Russia. We've made it clear and explicit that further NATO movement is where it's unacceptable. What's unclear? Is it us who places the missiles near the USA borders? No, it was the USA who came with its missiles to our house. They're on the doorstep of our house. You're demanding some guarantees from me. It is you who must give us the guarantees. You. Immediately. Now.
Now, Putin says Russia's security is threatened by Ukraine's growing ties with the Western military alliance. He says that NATO has cheated Russia with five waves of expansion since the Cold War. The U.S. and NATO accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow strongly denies that and plans talks with the U.S. and NATO early next year in order to defuse the tensions. In the press briefing, the Russian president also spoke about a gas crisis in Europe. He said it's unfair to blame Moscow for the crisis, as the Russian company Gazprom is meeting its obligations.
They lie all the time. They mix everything up. Gazprom supplies all the requisite gas volumes under current contracts. And not only that, but it's also increasing the volume by 12%, I guess, or around 20% of supplies far abroad and to Europe.
Well, Putin says that he suspects some Russian gas pipe to Germany was ultimately being resold to Ukraine. He added that Europe is stuck on long-term contracts and has created its own gas problems. The continent is grappling with record-breaking natural gas prices and a strong winter demand. Some analysts blame the spike on simmering tensions with Russia. That's the key supplier. Journalist and political commentator Fred Ware believes that the West is recognizing that it has pushed NATO's eastward expansion too far and is seeking dialogue with Moscow.
There is a war of words going on right now. You need to look past the rhetoric, the purple clouds of who's threatening whom, and see that they have agreed to talk. And the mood, both in the United States and in NATO, I think is much more congenial than it was in years past. I think everybody recognizes that they pushed NATO expansion too far. They have a case of indigestion, I mean, of a geostrategic nature. And also that they realize that Russia has rebounded. It's not the Russia of the 1990s anymore. It's a much stronger, more unified, and economically resilient place. It's got its deep security concerns. It's always had them. It isn't something new. It has never liked NATO expansion. The thought of Ukraine joining NATO has always made Russians see red spots before their eyes. It's just that now a strong Russia is drawing a line. And it also may have something to do with the fact that the United States in particular has shown itself to be strategically incoherent and incapable.
Now, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi tells the Iraqi foreign minister that a principal policy of Iran is to support the stability and the sovereignty of Iraq. Raisi was speaking with Fuad Hussein here in Tehran. He said that Iran views insecurity in neighboring Iraq as insecurity on Iranian soil. He also hailed the resistance of the Iraqi people and said that's the main reason making American forces leave the Arab country. The president said that once the U.S. enters a country, it does not leave unless it faces popular resistance. All right, moving on. Iranian foreign minister is saying that his country In a serious manner, continue talks with the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Iran will do that until negotiations result in a good agreement.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. On the whole, we did not see the position of some European countries as very constructive, specifically that of France. In the latest round of talks, the three European countries practically presented no new initiatives.
The official also said that Tehran rejects this approach, that the other parties offer one concession to get several in turn. Tehran, the remaining JCPOA members, have held seven rounds of talks in Vienna this year to resolve outstanding issues over the 2015 deal. Those issues began after the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018, reinstating sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its commitments a year later. Iran says it will fully meet its obligations only after the U.S. removes the sanctions. Vienna will host a new round of negotiations by the JCPOA members next week. Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli fire a day before. The mourning procession was held in Ramallah in the Akbar West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammed Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is critical of new Israeli rules that give soldiers more freedom to use deadly force. It says the rules are further proof of the Israeli military leaders' criminal behavior and terrorist policies that encourage the deliberate killing of innocent people. Israel has amended its open fire rules to allow soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones, even when they don't pose an imminent threat. From Ramallah, I'm joined by Mustafa Bakuti, who is with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council. Good to have with us, sir. So we've been watching this, especially in the past weeks, things are happening and more Palestinians are being killed. And as you just heard in the intro, there is this modification in the rule. They simply open fire on Palestinians who even do not pose any threat to Israeli soldiers. Why is this happening?
These are not isolated incidents. These are part of a strategy that the Israeli government is following. And it aims at suppressing any kind of Palestinian resistance or rejection of the Israeli plans to annex the West Bank. What is happening is that the Israeli army has decided to legalize committing war crimes against Palestinians, including shooting Palestinians even when they are representing no threat to anybody. And that the translation of that was the assassination of this young man who was Mohammed Abbas, who was killed in Ramallah. But before that, they shot the car of another Palestinian and they burned him alive inside that car. And these are incidents that keep repeating. In my opinion, what is happening is very dangerous because there is a serious shift in the Israeli establishment, not only to the right, but actually towards fascist behavior. And this shift is very much encouraged and supported and promoted by no less than 750,000 illegal settlers who are residing now in the West Bank and accelerating their attacks on the Palestinian people.
Mr. Bakuti, would these killings kind of stop the Palestinians from pursuing their cause?
Absolutely not. On the contrary, these acts practically provoke more Palestinian reaction, and it convinces every Palestinian that there is no security here for any Palestinian under occupation. It convinces every Palestinian that relying on any possible negotiations with Israel is useless, since this Israeli government is even rejecting any form or act of political discussion, and they declare every day that they are not going to allow a Palestinian statehood, they are not going to allow Palestinian freedom, and they insist on their process of settlement expansion and annexation. Practically, these acts convince Palestinians more than ever before that there is no use of building hopes on negotiations, and that they should unify themselves together in one struggle against occupation to remove not only the occupation, but the whole system of apartheid and racial discrimination that is practiced against the Palestinian people.
Okay, I appreciate your thoughts and comments. Mosal Barghouti from Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah. Saudi warplanes have conducted fresh airstrikes in Yemen, this time targeting Hudaydah province. At least a civilian got killed and another one injured in the latest attack. Saudi Arabia has stepped up its air raids on Yemen recently, pounding different locations there. The targets include the international airport and the capital Sana'a. Riyadh bombed the facility several times on Monday, bringing eight flights to a halt. Yemenis are dependent on aid supplies to survive, and that's because their country is under a land, sea, and air blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia as part of its aggression against their country. Now, that's why the World Food Program says it will reduce the food rations of 8 million Yemenis. It's suffering from a shortage of funds, and that's why the WFP already warned that the current level of hunger in Yemen is unprecedented and is causing severe hardship for millions of people there.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi-led war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding.
What the World Food Programme's done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operate expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Let's now turn to Afghanistan, where a bomb attack has rocked the capital city. The blast took place close to the gate of passport office in Kabul. Initial reports indicating it was a car bomb. The government saying that a suicide bomber has been killed and several people got injured. No group has claimed responsibility. In recent weeks, there have been a series of bombings and terrorist attacks across the country. They were mostly claimed by the Daesh terrorist group that's engaged in a fierce power rivalry with the Taliban. Meantime, the number of children in Afghanistan not getting enough to eat is on the rise. Health facilities in the country are overflowing with malnourished children. And UNICEF is warning time is running out to save Afghan children. Our correspondent has more from Kabul.
We are visiting Afghanistan's largest children's hospital in Kabul. These days, the hospital is receiving malnourished babies more than any time before. Doctors here say malnutrition has increased since the poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan, adding the hospital lacks beds and medicines.
The patients in our malnutrition wards have recently increased. There aren't enough rooms for them. Sometimes we have to place more than one patient on an individual bed. If the ongoing shortage of food and nutrition continues, more and more children will face malnutrition.
World countries should help Afghan malnourished mothers and children. It's obvious to all what's going on in Afghanistan. Our breadwinners are jobless as winter bites. Children and mothers are being malnourished as food is not brought to table.
According to UNICEF, 3.2 million children under the age of 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of the year. Authorities say world countries should not leave Afghan children alone.
Definitely, our hospital has been suffering from bad impacts of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has seized what belongs to Afghan innocent people, and it is a cruel attempt. I demand the international community send their humanitarian aid to Afghan people today, as they used to help our nation under the previous government.
Following the Taliban took over of the country, international funding to the Afghan people were cut off, and billions of dollars in Afghan assets were frozen by the U.S.
The war may be over in Afghanistan, but the nation now is struggling with an economic crisis. Half of the population of Afghanistan is facing acute hunger, and over 1 million Afghan children are at risk of dying. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
900 News. France will launch a lawsuit against Britain to settle a lingering dispute over post-Brexit fishing rights. The French Europe Minister says that the high-profile meeting with EU representatives will take place in early January. And then a suit will be filed with a special tribunal. Paris and London have been at loggerheads for months over how many licenses the French fishermen are entitled to. France accuses Britain of holding back on licenses. Last week, Britain agreed to issue an additional 23 licenses for French boats, but France believes it's entitled to around 80 more. Under a post-Brexit deal, EU fishermen can continue to work in British waters if they can prove they used to fish there. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. As former U.S. President Donald Trump's loyalists laid siege to democracy with voting restrictions and attempts to take over the running of elections, there are fears that Democrats in Washington have not fully woken up to the threat. We are prepared for you an article written jointly by Sam Levine and David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Republicans Are Shamelessly Working to Subvert Democracy. Are Democrats paying attention? As the first anniversary of the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol approaches, there is no shortage of warnings about the danger of a repeat by Republicans. But even as former U.S. President Donald Trump loyalists lay siege to democracy with voting restrictions and attempts to take over the running of elections, there are fears that Democrats in Washington have not fully woken up to the threat. Tony Evers, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin, said, "At the state level, we're raising hell about it, but the Democrats on the national level are talking about Build Back Better, the infrastructure bill, and lots of other things." He added, "When we think about voting rights and democracy, I would hope we would hear a little bit more about that from the national level." Hopes that the attack on the Capitol would break the fever of Trumpism in the Republican Party were soon dashed. All but a handful of its members in Congress voted against the 9/11-style commission to investigate the riot, and many at national level have downplayed it, rallying to the former president's defense. But it is an attritional battle playing out state by state, county by county, and precinct by precinct that could pose the biggest menace to the next election in 2024, a potential rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. An avalanche of voter suppression laws is being pushed through in Republican-led states, from Arizona to Florida, from Georgia to New Hampshire. Gerrymandered maps are being drawn up to form districts where demographics favor Republican candidates. Backers of Donald Trump's big lie of a stolen election are running to be the Secretary of State in many places, a position from which they would serve as the chief election official in their state. Donald Trump has endorsed such candidates in Michigan, in Arizona, in Georgia, and in Nevada, all crucial swing states. All-out assault suggests that Donald Trump and his allies learned lessons from their failed attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election, identifying weak points in the system and laying the groundwork for a different outcome next time. Dean Phillips, a Democratic congressman from Minnesota, said, "It looks like Plan B is populating state-elected offices with believers of the big lie and morally corrupt candidates. We should all be concerned about that, and, by the way, not just Democrats, but everybody should be concerned." Yet, despite waves of media coverage, recently including The Atlantic magazine and The Guardian and New York Times newspapers, Democrats face the challenge of getting their voters to care. Many are confronting inflation, crime, and other priorities, and may assume that, having defeated Donald Trump last year, they can stop paying attention. Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, says, "It's still very difficult to imagine the severity and depth of what Donald Trump tried to pull off. It's hard sometimes to recognize something when it's new. For the president of the United States to try and stage a coup is unprecedented. It's hard for people to wrap their heads around it." Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State described Donald Trump as a clear and present danger who is trying to remove the impediments that rescued democracy last time. State governors are not only the ones sounding the alarm bells, but about the dangers of complacency or assuming that normal services has resumed. Jenna Griswold, a Colorado Democrat seeking re-election, is chair of the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, which focuses on electing Democrats to those positions. She said, "While there's been a surge of attention from activists and donors to those races, it is not enough." She added, "I think one of the issues happening is that because this is the United States, the idea that our most fundamental freedom of living in a democracy is under attack is hard to really grasp." She added, "It's important that we keep leaning in because the folks on the other side are definitely leaning in." In Michigan, one of the leading candidates in the Republican field is Christina Camaro, who has spread lies about 6th of January and the election. She's seeking to oust Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat who became one of the most high-profile Secretaries of State in 2020 when she took steps to make it easier to vote by mail in her state. Like Jenna Griswold, Jocelyn Benson, who describes herself as avowedly not a partisan, said she noticed increased interest from voters and independent donors, but not from the National Democratic Party. She said, "We're not seeing the same sense of urgency that perhaps the other side has shown in investing in these offices." She added, "With the exception of the vice president, who's been enormously supportive and gets the importance of these offices from a voting rights standpoint, I have seen no significant increase in support from national party leaders that what we experienced in 2018, which wasn't insignificant." Acolytes of the so-called Stop the Steal movement are drilling down even deeper, targeting local election oversight positions that have traditionally been non-partisan and little noticed, with only a few hundred votes at stake and candidates often running unopposed. Yet these too could pull at the threads of a democratic fabric. For example, in Pennsylvania, there is concern that election deniers are running for a position called Judge of Elections, a little-known office that plays a huge role in determining how things are run on election day. Scott Seibold, Pennsylvania State Director of All Voting, is local, a voting advocacy group, said the role is essentially the top position at the precinct polling place on election day. He added, "They could cause huge disruption at the polls based on how the office holder interprets rules around ID and spoiling mail-in ballots." Scott Seibold agreed that not enough attention has been paid to these local races. He said, "There's no precedent for this, as far as we know, in sort of the modern history of elections. I don't think folks anticipated this. I'm not sure how seriously entities like the Democratic Party are taking this, but they ought to." Similar anxieties emerged recently when the grassroots movement Indivisible ran a focus group with members from Georgia, Indiana, North Carolina, and elsewhere. Ezra Levin, the group's co-founder and co-executive director, said, "They're worried about their governors, they're worried about their secretaries of state, and they're worried even at a more local level about previously non-partisan or uncontroversial election administration officials being taken over by a well-funded and very focused operation led by people who have embraced the big lie." Ezra Levin added, "These are not positions, especially at the local level, that are getting as much attention, but it's real. We see Steve Bannon, former White House Chief of Staff and now a right-wing podcast, trying to lead the charge, getting folks to take up the lowest level spots in the election administration ecosystem. It's happening right in front of our own eyes." Ezra Levin, a former congressional staffer, noted that the Democratic Party is not a monolith, but warned that Joe Biden has devoted his political capital, traveling the country to make speeches, holding meetings on Capitol Hill, to causes such as infrastructure rather than the future of democracy, adding, "This big missing puzzle piece in this entire fight for the last 11 months has been the president." Pressure on the Senate to act intensified these days when 17 governors wrote a joint letter expressing concern over threats to the nation's democracy. Evers of Wisconsin was among them. In a phone interview, he said Democrats in his crucial battleground state are highlighting the full-throated attack on voting rights, but acknowledged that voters have numerous other concerns as well. Evers added, "Everybody's talking about it, but when they go home from the Capitol and they're visiting with people, I'm guessing that the conversation talks about more bread and butter things like, I want my roads fixed, and thank you for reducing taxes."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us again on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. First and foremost, I'd like to apologize for my nasal voice. It's rain season and flus and colds are going around. Secondly, but more importantly, I'm joined by my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamri. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So we've been talking about the fascinating topic of shopping. Whether you like it or not, it's still fascinating. It fascinates me how other people enjoy shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who actually enjoy shopping, of course it's fascinating. And we talked about how most women enjoy it a lot.
And it's not, it doesn't have to do with from which ethnicity you're from. It's an international thing.
Exactly. And men don't.
Usually men don't. My dad is an exception.
May Allah prolong his life. We were trying to highlight the fact that it's very important for us to create a balance. It's okay to an extent, enjoy the riches of this world, so long as it's halal. Allah says so himself. كُلُّ مِنْ طَيْبَاتِ مَا رَزَقْنَاكُمْ. Enjoy it, it's halal, it's there for a reason, you know? But we definitely have to draw a line.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for us to commit israf and wastefulness in every aspect of our lives, and shopping is definitely not an exception.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
When you give that example of people whose wardrobes are like busting with clothes, and they just keep adding to that.
But when you look at the teachings of Islam, you see that up to a certain extent, you're allowed to use, as you said, the riches of the world. For example, I remember reading in a hadith that it says it's actually recommended to buy your young girls jewelry and nice clothes so that they would be presentable when it's time for them to, to find their proper suitors, right? Yeah. So to look your best and to be perfumed, when you look at the sunnah of the noble prophet, you see that he spent 1/3 of his income on buying perfume, right? So being presentable and looking your best has a very special place in the teachings of Islam. I think we have to distinguish two things, cleanliness and being presentable from being very trendy, buying expensive brands
exactly.
And, just being crazy about I have to have this style of Apple phone has just come out. I just have to have it. Because you see lines outside of shopping malls when a special kind of
new edition is out.
Some people see themselves like they go crazy about it.
They define their worth with that item.
Exactly.
And if they don't have it, they deem themselves worthless. And that's sad because this person had so much potential to be valuable from a spiritual or even intellectual aspect. They abandoned that aspect of themselves and focused entirely on this material thing that changes every year and allowed that to define their worth. What you said about being clean and tidy is important. Reminds me of a hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, where his eminence says, do not do israf in your clothes by wearing your outside clothes at home, and wearing it out, and then you're forced to buy more clothes.
That is beautiful.
Isn't it? The little detail that the imam teaches us. If you are just organized enough to, when you get home, change your clothes into your PJs or comfy home clothes, house clothes, and that set of outside clothes will stay new. Or that the imam says it doesn't matter whether you wear old or new clothes as long as it's clean and tidy.
Exactly.
I see a lot of people, especially in the Hausa community, you find a lot of the tulab, the seminary students, they're not well off, but they keep their clothes well kept and they groom themselves when they come out. And you really feel like, oh, he's such a dignified person.
That is so beautiful.
Rather than someone who's scruffy and who's... clothes smell like food and there's stains on it.
Exactly.
No matter how knowledgeable they are, you feel like, I don't want to interact with them.
That is so true. And this is something that the Prophet paid a lot of attention. I remember that actually he himself did all the cleaning of his clothes. In one hadith, you read that when you went somewhere, from the smell of the perfume of the Prophet, who you could realize that His Holiness, His Eminence, was in that place. According to the Islamic teachings, you can spend a good amount of your money on things to look very presentable and good in the society, such as perfume, but you have to be very careful not go into extreme. And the example of the Lady Fatima to Zahra on her wedding night, that she gave her new dress, her wedding dress,
exactly,
to this poor lady. This is definitely a lesson for all of us, that girls these days, they would, you know, program and plan for their wedding
for months.
And the
money they spend on it. And then what happens?
If you don't go into extremes, and if you have a balanced practice of spending, like, you know, for your wedding night, I think it's totally acceptable. You have to, you know, the urf or the norm of the society accepts until a certain level of, you know, spending for your wedding night. And especially for the food that you give to the people. We have hadith that actually you have to make your wedding nights to be known to everybody. They know that you actually got married.
I'm joined by Sister Razia Shamili, and stay with us on this discussion.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So we did talk about the latest fashion trends that attracts women to the shopping. And this desire to buy the latest fashion is created in you by the advertisement that you're bombarded with on the billboards, on television, on Instagram, on all the social medias. You know, this trend is so popping into your face every second of your life that you just feel that you have to have that shirt, that watch, that pair of pants, that whatever.
If you
don't
have it, there's something fundamentally wrong with you.
Exactly.
That's how they make you feel.
Exactly. So that is number one, that women like to go, you know, after shopping. The second one, as I told you, it's, you know, this life that builds up worries and frustration for you. Women sometimes see it as a mood lifter. You know, it takes away their attention, away from all the stresses and anxieties and problems that they have. Some hours of their life, they feel released because of the change of mood, because of the change of atmosphere, you know, the
that
new place they go.
That is very interesting. Now that you put it that way, men do the same thing.
For shopping?
Yeah. Hardware stuff. Every man I've seen in my life, my father, my brothers, when they go into a hardware store and shop for themselves,
mashallah,
or tell themselves that I need this new drill, a drill that he will never use, stuff for their car.
Did you pay attention that when you go shopping, you see a lot of men sitting on benches inside the shopping mall, and the ladies are inside?
If they have a proper, healthy relationship,
they would go with her.
They would go in with her, tell her, no, this doesn't look nice. No, that makes you look fat. Oh, this color makes you look pale.
You know, a lot of men, it's not just, I think what you said may contribute to the reason why some men are sitting outside. But then it's sometimes it's just they don't have the nerves, because the girl, she wants to buy this skirt. She goes to all the stores in that shopping mall. She tries them on. And then she says, oh, I couldn't find the right.
It takes them forever to buy something like a new jack or a new part for their car.
Really?
They have to do weeks of research.
Your men in your family are very smart and they are very hands-on. Not all men are like that. One more thing that might be related to the Islamic point indirectly is that one of the reasons that women like to shop is to look their best and to look unique.
That is definitely a feminine thing.
Because according to some researchers and thinkers, they say that in all the domains of life, men are the dominant figure. They decide for the society, because, you know, the important influential roles in the society are for men. In families, men are the ones who make the final decisions. So there's little space left for women to feel in power. So when women go shopping, they find this sense of buying something that they want, which is so unique for them. They find it as a means, tools of giving them a sense of power. This is just an idea. Mm. But when I thought about it, in some cases, it could be true.
It's a sad life to live. The only control you have over yourself is the clothes you wear.
Exactly.
We're going to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
But then again, I understand that whole women liking to show off. It's an innate quality of women more than men. And that's why in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala addresses this matter and tells them not to do tabarruj, because He knows that's something that they would struggle with throughout their lives if they don't put it under control. And I think that's why we are instructed to adorn ourselves with the hijab. Wear the hijab. Please don't ruin the peace of the society with your beauty.
And yourself.
Yeah, and yourself.
But then in another sphere of women's lives, mm. Allah, this is a natural need. This
to
is
be
a
noticed.
Physical need
to be complimented.
Yeah, to be complimented, to be told that you're special, you're beautiful, you're gorgeous, okay? You have to be told that. So it's something from within, right?
It's necessary for her mental health.
Exactly. So this has, in the Islamic perspective, this need is met in the private realm of life. Mm. So we cannot stress it, you know,
enough
to say that, as you said, this spousal relationship is the first priority in a woman's life. The number one role that a woman should play is to do something and to put her most energy in being a loving wife for her husband.
Mm.
Right. And when this is in place, when your spousal relationship is in place, so many other pieces of the puzzle in your family would also fit in.
Mm.
Right. So in a lot of ahadith, as they tell us that you should not wear perfume outside and the angels would curse you from the moment you leave the house until the moment you return, it also tells you that according to the fuqaha, according to the jurisprudence, one of the roles, wajib, obligatory roles of women, is to try to fulfill introductory steps in meeting the sexual needs of men, how to look their best, to wear their best, to put on really nice makeup, perfume, their best clothes, and to present themselves to their husbands and that they're lovely and that they love them so much.
Mm. That's all very interesting points. And thank you so very much, Sister Razia.
Thank you
for our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men. and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new joint roadmap signals Russia and China's willingness to resist U.S. pressure through combined military efforts if necessary. We have prepared for you an article written by M.K. Badrakumar, a former Indian diplomat. The piece is titled G7 Threats Push Russia and China Ever Closer Together. The initiative by Beijing to propose a virtual meeting between President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin, which took place recently, transforms the geopolitics of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's NATO's relentless eastward expansion and the Western military deployments on Russia's borders. The announcement of the meeting in Beijing came within a day of a Group of Seven G7 meeting of foreign ministers in Liverpool, England, on Sunday, 19th of December, which echoed Washington's rhetoric over an alleged Russian military buildup on the Ukrainian border and threatened Moscow with massive consequences and severe costs in response. The G7 foreign ministers' meeting itself was intended as a new show of Western unity against Russia and China to get the West on the front foot. For the first time, ASEAN countries were also included in the G7 ministerial as a part of a plan by U.S. President Joe Biden's administration to begin a new Indo-Pacific economic framework in a renewed attempt to roll back China's influence in the region. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Ambassador Wang Wenbin, said on Monday, 20th of December, that the virtual meeting between President Xi Jinping and President Vladimir Putin was expected to take stock of the bilateral relations and cooperation outcomes over this year, make top-level design for the relations next year, and exchange views on major international and regional issues of common concern. Spokesman Wang Weibin anticipated that the Xi Jinping-Vladimir Putin video conference will further enhance our high-level mutual trust, vigorously promote China-Russia back-to-back strategic coordination, and a robust development of all-round practical cooperation. And he concluded by saying, This will provide more stability and positive energy for the complex and fluid international landscape. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov later disclosed that President Vladimir Putin and President Xi Jinping would address during the talks NATO's belligerent rhetoric and the tense situation in Europe. To quote Dmitry Peskov, the two leaders will exchange their views on international affairs, the recent developments in international affairs, especially on the European continent, are now very tense, and this definitely requires discussion between the allies, between Moscow and Beijing. Dmitry Peskov added that Russia is facing a very aggressive rhetoric both from NATO and from the United States, which also needed to be discussed. In effect, Peskov highlighted that the emergent tense situation on the European continent warrants Russia holding consultations with its close ally China. No doubt this signifies an extraordinary dimension to the Russia-China alliance. What role, if any, China is going to play in the evolving scenario will be keenly watched, in particular as winds for a perfect storm are howling in both Eastern Europe and the Asia-Pacific region. Most importantly, would the discussion fall within the ambit of the plan for Russia-China military cooperation for 2021 through to 2025, which the two countries signed on 23rd of November? While signing the document, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu was quoted as saying, "China and Russia have been strategic partners for many years. Today, in conditions of increasing geopolitical turbulence and growing conflict potential in various parts of the world, the development of our interaction is especially relevant." Specifically, the Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu drew the attention of his Chinese counterpart, Wei Fenghe, to increasing intensive flights by U.S. strategic bombers near Russian borders. He said, "This month, 10 U.S. strategic bombers practiced the scenario of using nuclear weapons against Russia practically simultaneously from the western and eastern directions, and came as close as 20 kilometers to the Russian border." Sergei Shoigu also noted a rise in the number of U.S. bomber flights over the Sea of Okhotsk, where they practiced the launch of cruise missiles, saying it posed a threat to both Russia and China. Sergei Shoigu said, "In such an environment, the Russia-Chinese coordination becomes a stabilizing factor in global affairs." In a brief statement, China's defense ministry said, "At that point, the two sides would continue to deepen strategic cooperation between the two militaries, continue to strengthen cooperation in strategic exercises, joint patrols and other areas, and continue to make new contributions to safeguarding the core interests of both China and Russia and maintaining international and regional security and stability." Yet, the Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu was speaking only a few weeks ago. Reporting on the pact, the South China Morning Post commented that China and Russia are edging closer to a de facto military alliance to counter growing pressure from the United States. At the very least, the signing of the roadmap on military cooperation signaled Russia and China's willingness to resist U.S. pressure by relying on combined military efforts, if necessary. The United States is unable simultaneously to confront both China and Russia militarily, and if the latter were significantly to pool its military power and foreign policy objectives, that would alter the Eurasian balance of power and disadvantage the United States. The U.S. still claims to have the most capable military in the world, but a newfound unity between Russia and China could be strategically draining for Washington. Lyle Goldstein, an expert on China and Russia who served for 2 decades as a research professor at the Naval War College up until October, told Newsweek magazine on Monday. He said, "I think Moscow and Beijing calculate that they can really keep Washington in a kind of maximum confusion because the theaters are so distant from each other and the forces involved are quite different. I do think they see a gain here in kind of pulling Americans in 2 directions at once." Curiously, in Goldstein's estimation, he said, "I don't think the United States is prepared to go to war in Ukraine. I don't think the United States is prepared to go to war over Taiwan. I stand by both of those points. So, to do both, no, absolutely not." He explained that the Ukraine and Taiwan scenarios in particular are maximally stressing, as they involve high-intensity warfare in theaters that are extremely difficult against opponents that have the single measure of focus. Either one of them, on their own, would be highly stressing, and I would argue, if we were to get involved, there's a good possibility that we might lose. Be that as it may, the video call sets the stage for Vladimir Putin's visit to Beijing at Xi Jinping's personal invitation as the chief guest at the upcoming Winter Olympics from 4th to 20th of February. From the look of it, the two leaders' face-to-face meeting in Beijing in early February will be an event of great significance for global stability and the further consolidation of the strategic partnership between the two countries. As Kui Heng, a well-known Chinese scholar at the Center for Russian Studies of East China Normal University, told the Global Times, "Conceivably, the virtual meeting amid the rising tensions in Russia's relations with the United States is a display of the realization in Beijing that only by joining hands can China and Russia counter the attack from the United States-led clique and avoid falling into passivity. Lest it gets overlooked, the Treaty of Good Neighborliness and Friendly Cooperation signed by China and Russia in 2001 enshrines that Russia recognizes the government of the People's Republic of China as the sole legal government representing the whole of China. Taiwan is a constituent part of China. The pact is a foundational document on which the Sino-Russian alliance is anchored."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.